Welcome, everyone, to the episode 9 of the Office Hours podcast. Today we have with us Mo, and I'm really excited to learn about all the different topics he brought for us today. I'd like to share the Telegram. Please join the Telegram. You can find a link in the description, and I'll probably plug in the QR code somewhere in the vicinity, just like the last time. It would be fun meeting all of you there. And overall, yeah, I'm pretty excited. Episode 9. I mean, that's kind of cool. Just a little bit, some time ago, there was 0 episodes, and then there was 1, and now there's 9, and soon there's going to be 10. And 10 feels like quite a milestone, so next week we'll be recording number 10. I'm excited.
Yeah. I am, too. I am. I feel very happy about the progress. You know, it's really good. I'm excited about it.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. How are you doing, Vasily?
I'm doing well. Quite busy. We're nearing a release. We have a release in basically less than a week. So, you know, everything's getting a little bit more tense as we're finishing up all of our different tasks and items. We're going to make it. It's fine. But, you know, it feels a little bit rushed. And we really need some time to do refactoring, but it feels like there's another release that's going to be happening immediately after this one. So I don't know if we're going to get a chance to catch our breath a little bit and do some refactorings, but I guess we'll see. How about you?
It's going good on my side. Like, we have a release in about a week or so. So, and it's going really good. So I'm really happy about this one. Sometimes, you know, like when you say it's going good, you probably sound like optimistic, but in reality, this one is going good. So, it's good.
Right on. Yeah. No, that's always nice when you finish something and, you know, you feel the certain sense of accomplishment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then when you start thinking about all the corners they have cut in the process, you're like, I hope none of that shows up anytime soon.
Yeah, that's true. But, you know, we do our best. We try to make sure that it's a good quality, at least like to represent a good brand.
Yeah, for sure.
So today, I want to talk to you about freelancing and consultancy in tech, you know. How do you feel about this idea as a developer?
If you can pull it off, I think it's great. I guess that really depends on what you want. It's a different approach, mostly because you have to find clients, you have to keep clients, you have to, like, you are ultimately responsible for what you're doing, and if you have the skill to pull it off, it probably can work really well. It can be more stressful, you know, because again, doing freelancing has very little certainty. You know, you could be signed up for a contract that is like for a year, and it kind of feels like, oh yeah, they just got to extend because the project keeps on going, and then you're just like, yeah, we're not extending, so that's it, you're done. And that side, you know, when you're working full time, unless you do something really egregious, you're probably going to be working full-time for foreseeable future, unless the company goes out of business or something major needs to happen for that to be interrupted. And so you can have that peace of mind if you're salaried. But when you're doing freelance, everything really depends on all sorts of factors. And, you know, clients can drop off, their budgets could run out, and you kind of have to be mentally prepared for that. And, you know, there's like upsides and downsides. Upsides is like, okay, well, you pick your rate and it's an hourly rate, and, you know, there's no overtime rates, but, you know, you can work 24 hours a day if you want to, right? So if you can saturate their budgets and you can not go crazy working such long hours, you can probably pull it off. On a downside, you know, you're responsible for your own medical benefits, you're responsible for your own taxes, so you have to be very careful about, you know, collecting money, setting aside appropriate parts for paying your taxes and all of that kind of stuff. So, you know, get a good accountant if you're going to be doing that. You probably need to at least incorporate. A bunch of years back, if you had a sole proprietorship in Canada, companies were mostly okay with it. Now I think they want some indemnity, so it's better to be incorporated, which again, provincially, you can do it online, costs a couple of hundred bucks, and you know, doesn't take that long. However, that also imposes certain accounting practices on you because you have to have like corporate tax returns and you have to do like all of these things. So it's a little bit of a different ball game. But on the other side of things too, I can just relate it as a sort of a personal anecdote where I was doing consulting for a company and it was essentially like a intermediate web development role. So I was plugging some holes. And I had another fellow who started roughly around the same time with me in roughly the same role, but he was salaried and I was a consultant. And the just interpersonal dynamics, I was listened to more compared to him, even though we were doing basically the same job, because, you know, I was a highly paid consultant and he was just a salaried employee. So because they were paying all of this money for my services, they tend to take it more seriously. Even though I was very early in my career and, you know, I mean, I was never boastful about my skill, but again, I probably knew way less compared to what I know right now. But hey, they were pretty happy to listen to my suggestions. So there's certainly that.
Yeah, you know, I have a few questions about what you just mentioned. So first of all, like you mentioned about being incorporated. Do you think even if you work as a full-time employee, do you feel like it's a good idea to still be incorporated, or that doesn't work as much?
Well, if you're salaried, it would be completely parallel. Like if you have some business on the side and you want to run those incomes through the corporation. I mean, I'm not an accountant, so I don't fully know necessarily how that works. But I think when if you're working as a consultant, it works better if you're incorporated. But if you're salaried, then the fact that you also have a corporation doesn't really matter because they're not hiring a corporation, they're hiring you as a person, right? So that still goes as your personal income and your personal everything. So it wouldn't really make a difference unless you are specifically there as a contractor.
Yeah. I think the reason why I asked is because I know some people who work like this. They
So,
work
yeah.
for a company, but they work with
Do you like through a
the
staffing agency or something like
yeah.
that?
No. I'm trying to say like they have this incorporation,
So they
but I
probably
don't
work
know.
as a contractor then.
Yeah,
Which,
probably.
yeah, it's, but so if they're a contractor, they're not going to be salaried. They're likely going to be hourly. And they're not going to be maybe as tightly integrated into the company's infrastructure, maybe. That really depends. Like in some companies, contractors are like very limited in terms of like access they have to internal tools and things like that. They kind of keep them slightly on the outside. But it depends on the company and how they organize these things. But yeah, I imagine if they work as a through a corporation, they're likely going to be some type of contractor.
Yeah, but you know, I'm curious about something. Like, why is it like very common for companies to listen more to consultants than their internal employees? I find it very interesting because the employee probably knows more about what he's saying, but because it's a consultant, you know, I don't know if that works very much with us in tech because.
I don't know. I think that also depends. I think it's a perception thing, right? And also, I think that consultants can charge a higher rate, and they justify it by saying, I have specialized skills, and you need something sort of in a very short period of time, and you need it done. And you know, so you pay me to get it done. And based on that, I think It's like, hey, we're paying this guy all this money. He must be good. Otherwise, he wouldn't be worth as much, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I guess because, like, sometimes, like, even me, I've been a consultant before, and it's surprising, like, how much people want to listen to you. But you're probably know just as much as, like, the developers themselves.
Right.
True, you can know, like, you can be specialized in different tools or, like, in a particular language or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Whatever. But yeah, when it comes to, like, the code base itself, like, the actual job itself, I think...
I was just thinking of something that I think it might depend on how the company approaches their IT in general. Like, if it's an IT-centric company and they have permanent staff of IT, and you as a contractor come in to do something very specific and very tailored, they're likely going to be more appreciative of what you have to say. But if it's a non-IT company and they happen to have some sort of IT project and they just hired a whole bunch of contractors to get it done for them, then maybe the dynamic will be completely different, because A, they don't necessarily appreciate the complexities of the things being built. They can't reliably do quality control, because if they're not an IT shop, they don't have internal expertise to make sure that what being done is done well. And so that tends to deteriorate rather quickly. It's you come in on a project that's been previously built by contractors, and contractors in that type of scenario definitely have this don't give a crap attitude about what they're building. You know, they need to fill out their billable hours. They need to, you know, utilize the budgets. And the other thing that I noticed that's happening a lot in these situations is that the contractors end up being a bunch of yes men, as in they'll say yes to anything. They don't care, because the more things they say yes to, the more budgets they get and the more billable hours they can claim. And quality doesn't matter. The client wants a feature, yes, we can get it done. Even though internally it's a complete pile of crap,
yeah,
and it's just totally horrible and, like, doesn't fit the architecture, if there is an architecture, like, whatever. I worked on a couple of projects that was built by contractors for a non-IT company, and usually it's a mess. It's a huge mess. It's very poorly written. The other thing, too, is a lot of times these types of developments get outsourced to some type of, like, consulting shop. And a consulting shop has bodies that they throw on different projects. And people could be working on multiple projects at the same time. And, like, the rotation of people on such projects is crazy. So somebody can come in, write two files out of, like, 1,500 file project and never return to it again. So there's no consistency, there's no rhyme, there's no reason. Everybody does their own thing the way that they're used to doing it. And everything just turns into this just massive kaleidoscope of weirdness that is impossible to get through. So I haven't been doing that type of work, but I've been on the end where we've inherited that type of work, and it's never fun. So
yeah, I can imagine, but I don't think it's true that a lot. I don't know. Maybe it's true, but I don't know really, like, if it's true that consultants don't put in effort into the job because they are consultants, like, they can walk out the door anytime. I think that would really be a personal thing. But I find, like, a lot of people talk about this type of thing, like a stereotype, like, oh, he's a consultant, he doesn't really care. He just says, he just does what he wants, and he knows that he can leave at any time. But
yeah,
I think it boils down to personality,
yeah,
no?
Yeah, I think it does. And I think also if you're there by yourself, or maybe there's, like, a small group that comes in for a very specific job, it might not be like that. But if you are there as part of the sweatshop, and as much work ethic you could have, you're also likely going to be surrounded by people who don't care. And it's really hard to maintain. And I think people who care likely filter out of those types of arrangements pretty quickly, because, you know, they're forced by the economical realities to ship crappy code all day. And if it pains them to do so, they're likely just going to filter out of that entire enterprise. And people who don't care, as long as they're getting paid, they'll stamp out whatever day after day, they'll remain. And so all of the conscious people filter out and all of the people who don't care remain. And so overall, it turns into an environment where it pays to not care compared to otherwise. So yeah, don't work for a sweatshop.
But when it comes to developers caring about the project, does it not boil down to personality really? Because you can have like a developer, I think everybody has different attitude to work, you know?
Yeah.
Some people, they have the attitude of like, well, I just, this is the job. I do my job. Yeah. I go home at 5. That's
yeah.
it.
Yeah, it's a 9 to 5.
Some people have the attitude of like, this has to be good. We have a brand here, you know? My name is on Discord, you know?
Yeah, it's true. But that's true of any kind of profession. You're going to have people who care and you're going to have people who don't care. And maybe kind of going back to one of the episodes when we were talking about company culture, is if the company culture values people who care and who want to do a good job and they give them the resources and time. Because the thing is, okay, so if you really want to do a good job, it's going to take longer usually. You have to be more considered. You have to be more methodical. You have to think things through. It takes more time to deliver higher quality product, right? Because, you know, the first thing you compromise on is quality when the crunch is on. And, you know, we have the project that's in crunch right now. And, well, certain things are just, we like, okay, we'll fix it later, hoping that the later for that comes, right? And yeah. So in this case, the company is less interested in overall quality and attention to detail as they do for, you know, hitting the milestone and releasing at a certain date, because they have their own set of incentives, right? They want to launch something, they want to capture some market by a particular date, they want to work for some events, some seasonal things that are happening that they want to capture, so they need to be done, right? So if it happens to be not the best quality, better have slightly lower quality and be able to capture most of the market than wait and miss on the opportunity. So they have economic drivers that, you know, it's understandable why they operate this way. So a lot of times it kind of becomes this situation where I'd like to deliver high quality, but, you know, the incentives are not aligned for that. So I have to do the best job that I can. And if it's grating on your soul that you have to do kind of a, you have to cut all these corners day after day, I think, again, eventually you're going to filter out because it's like just not pleasant to be in that situation. So yeah, it kind of depends. And if the company culture allows to foster that type of stuff, you know, people who don't care, depending on, again, on how aggressive the company is in trying to get rid of people like that, because, you know, there's nothing inherently wrong with people who want to work their 9 to 5 and be given tasks and complete those tasks and leave. In fact, you need a couple of people like that in your project, because you can just pile up all the menial type of work on them and they'll be perfectly happy doing that, and they're not going to be trying to come up with something fancy and sophisticated because they're not that invested into it, but they're dependable in terms of just raw output. So it's like, the thing is, if you have a whole bunch of very creative people, it becomes really difficult too, because very creative people don't necessarily want to work on very boring and mundane parts that need to be done. So you have to maintain that balance in terms of the team composition. Like, you have to have a couple of, you know, worker bees that are there putting in the effort of delivering all of the more menial tasks that are necessary.
Yeah. I'm thinking about this, like maybe in the future, for anyone thinking about building a team, maybe You don't necessarily want to have an all-star team. You want to have some people who are not, you're like almost stars or like just
Because
you think
I
this is
think
a
with like with the with stardom also usually comes ego a lot of times too. And the more ego you have on a team, the more clashes they're gonna happen. So, you
true.
know, it's the team composition is a tricky thing, and I think it's kind of a natural thing because like people have to adjust to one another as well, like matching their personal styles and matching their sort of personalities. And sometimes it happens, and sometimes there's conflict, and sometimes there's other things. So yeah, it's not easy. And I think, yeah, if you just hire a bunch of superstars, I don't, it's probably good in terms of like the quality of the output, but it might create other problems that are not related to like the code itself. It's more likely gonna be like interpersonal stuff.
But you know, just for the benefit of everyone else listening to us, like and I would like us to clearly like explain the difference between being a freelance developer and a consultant, because I think there's a thin line between these two. What do you think?
Well, I don't know, is there? Like what would that line be?
You know, because as a freelance developer, I think you have full autonomy over yourself. Like you decide what you do. You decide who you work for. You decide literally everything is in your choice.
Yeah.
And you find the job yourself. But
Yes.
as a consultant that works for a consulting firm,
Okay, so if we're talking about a person who's completely solo versus someone who works through a like staffing or consulting firm, then yeah, there's obviously a difference because they resell you at a premium usually, so you never collect the entire amount, and the company gets charged way more compared to what you make. I've been in that situation myself where I accidentally discovered once how much my employer was charging the company that I was consulting for, and it was like interesting.
interesting.
That I did not expect that big of a difference, but okay. But you know, it's fine. It's the thing is too, in that type of situation, the company I was working for made agreements with the company that they sold my services to, and they agreed on a price. I made agreements with the company I was working for, and we settled on a price. So, you know, it's perfectly fine. It was one of those things is like, I haven't been asking for it, so why would they give me more where they can keep more for themselves, right?
Yeah, true. You know, for me, at some point in my career, I tried to work directly as a freelancer, but the reason why I wanted to do that at the time was because I was really curious. Like I was the beginning of my career, I felt like I was a very curious. I just wanted to do everything. I wanted to know how everything was. I felt like if I work in a company, I'm really like restricted to knowing just about this particular product, and I don't get the opportunity to do whatever I want or like go at my own pace, you know, really. So I'm curious, what kind of advice would you give to people who feel this way and also want to, because that's exactly the same kind of mindset that got me into consulting also, you know.
Right,
But
right.
when you have this type of mindset, like you want to touch so many things, you want to see so many work environments, you want to see so many tools, you want to write so many programming languages, you know, like this kind of thing, like what kind of
Right,
advice would you
right.
give to this kind of people?
Yeah, for sure. I think that it's not you, if you're a freelancer. So here's the thing, being a freelancer, like one of the benefits of working in a salaried role is that I think is that you can learn on a job. They will be more willing to teach you on a job because they're investing in you as a person who's going to be with the team and going to help company solve its problems. So if you don't know a bunch of things, a salaried role is probably better for it. You might be focused into a specific area, but at least they're like, well, we're investing in this person, so everything they don't know that they will learn during the course of them working for us, we get to keep the benefits of that for a while if everything works out. Because, I mean, it's possible that, you know, you're going to learn a bunch of things and be like, thanks for nothing, have a great day, right? But most of the time, you're still going to stick with the company for a while and they can reap the benefits of investing that time and resources into you. When you're a freelancer, I would imagine that you're expected to know your stuff. So if you come in and they pay you hourly rate and you don't know something, that's kind of a bad outlook, because they hired someone who's not competent and they're going to be less likely to extend the same kind of courtesy to you as a consultant or as a freelancer, because they need something done and you're not capable of delivering. And by the time you're done, you're gone. So they're not investing into you for their benefit long term. They're investing into you for the benefit short term. So if you cannot deliver on that short term promise, not a good look.
So yeah, I agree.
Yeah. If you want to learn like a lot of different things and you're young, join a startup. You know, the risk is high. The salary probably is not going to be as good. Stock options, whatever. I mean, you know, statistically, if 98% of startups fail, 98% of time, the chances of you seeing any kind of return on those stock options is very, very small.
Yeah.
So, but you get to wear all of the hats, especially if you join in an early stage. Like so joining a startup and starting a startup is like different things. You probably want to join a startup that is somewhat established, maybe that is small, maybe there's like 10, 20 people, because there's still a lot of areas that they need to cover and you'll learn so much, you know, because, but yeah, there's all these risks. So maybe if you're far into your career, then maybe you already acquired all of the skills. So it's not really something. But like if you're entering this business of IT in general, and you're not 20 anymore, and you might not be willing to take such risks, like if you have a family and a mortgage, you know, joining a startup, like,
yeah,
it can be tricky. You know, I was talking to a bunch of my former colleagues recently, and they said that, you know, some of the companies they were working on are in quite a turmoil, and, you know, people get fired, things fall apart. Like two separate people from two completely different companies said, oh, everything's just going crazy. So yeah, I mean, these things happen, and in startups especially so. So if you're going to work for a sweatshop, so to speak, to like a staffing agency or a consulting firm, you're likely going to be seeing a lot of projects, but I feel a lot of times you're going to be fairly limited to the set of tools, because they want everybody to be roughly of the same skill set. So you're likely, if it's one of those types of companies, it's likely going to be very specialized in terms of like, oh yeah, it's going to be like a Java shop, or it's going to be a PHP shop or a Rails or something, maybe a little bit of cross-pollination between the two. But you're going to be working on different projects, mostly doing the same thing. Like, it's, I don't know if I'd be interested in working under these kinds of arrangements. So I can't really expand too much on that. But yeah, if you want to learn a lot of things in a very short amount of time, join a startup. But yeah, the pay is not as good. Stress is through the roof because everything's on fire all the time in startups. You're just running around, you know, swapping one hat for the other, but you learn a lot. Yeah. And if you're young and if you're just entering the market, I think that one of the best ways to kind of, you know, to trial by fire type situation.
Yeah. In my experience, I find like, it's true. Joining a startup really, it helps in, to build different aspect of your skill, of your career. Like, at the end of the day, like you get to learn the job as well as get to learn the business also, if you are interested in that.
But yeah.
And also, one thing I learned about like freelancing is like, in the beginning, even though like, I don't think it's a very good idea to start with like in the beginning of your career, because like you said, there's a lot of expectation. It's like you want to It's like going on Fiverr, for example. Exactly. Good analogy. Yeah. For example, if you go on Fiverr to get a service, to buy a service, you expect the person that you're buying the service for to know exactly what you're doing. And maybe it's possible that you probably are not at that level yet. So especially if depending on the project too, because
Yeah.
sometimes people have different level of project.
Yeah.
As a freelancer, maybe like if you're just starting out, you might just be building basic website or basic applications, maybe something. But once you get to a point where you start working with
Yeah.
like applications that has to be like, 10,000 users or something like that, then it gets more complicated and you get to need more information and more level of expertise. So I think it can be challenging in terms of knowledge, but I think it depends. It depends on your level of tenacity. Like,
Yes. And I think also other thing that can be a factor is if it's a fixed rate contract, like you're being paid a fixed amount of money to do something, and usually there's going to be a timeline, but if you have a lot of skill and you can finish sooner, you get more money per hour. But if you have to learn a bunch of things in the meantime, because it's a fixed rate contract, you're going to spend way more of your time. So it kind of dilutes the hourly rate because you're working more hours and you might not be able to have enough time to pick up other projects at the same time. But maybe in this situation, you can kind of skim, by with not knowing certain things and sort of supplementing on a go. But fixed rate contracts are exactly what they are. It's like you agreed on a specific sum and you're not going to get anything more over that. And usually, if you try to extend deadlines, that's not a good sign. If you try to ask for more money because you took longer, that's also not a good sign. So there's like some wiggle room in it, but it's tough. And reputation building is hard and it takes a long time, but reputation destruction is very swift. So you have to be very, very conscious of it. And the other thing I just remember too is if you're going for the freelance thing, especially in Canada, I don't know exact details. Again, consult with your accountant. But I think right now you have to have more than one client simultaneously. Otherwise, there's some additional tax implications on what you do, which makes it. I heard it from a friend who wanted to do like a freelance type gig, but she only had one client at the moment. And she said that additional tax implications make the whole enterprise not worthwhile at all. So you have to have multiple things at once to qualify for these things. So again, talk to your accountant and figure it out.
I think so. But what would you advise freelancers like when it comes to finding clients? Like, what do you think is the best strategy for finding clients and projects?
That is a really good question. That is a $1 million question. Because that's, I think, that is one of the hardest parts about doing it. I think a lot of the people that I've known who were doing this type of work, usually they have some type of whale contract that is a multi-year contract with a big company that just keeps on getting renewed, that effectively pays all of their bills and occupies most of their time. And then they have other contracts on a side. And if that whale of a contract happened to terminate or something goes south, they find themselves in a very precarious situation because now, like, the bulk of their income is gone. And because if you find a contract like this, it might be, oh, I have this big contract. I don't have to worry about things as much. But what also happens is you don't look for other contracts as much because that contract is big and it occupies a lot of your time. So you're not really hedging your risks. And it's tough. I think you need to have access to the industry. You have to be present and visible. You have to like attend things when people who might be looking for your services congregate. I honestly, I've been working salaried positions for such a long time. Like I haven't really done any of that in a while. I don't even if I were to start from scratch right now, I wouldn't even necessarily know what I would where I would start. So I don't know.
Well, for me, I think one of the few places or how I know the strategy, I think the best one will be word of mouth, because I know like it's the easiest to actually get the contracts. Like, you know, you work for someone who also knows someone that knows someone, and then you can build your network from there. But I also know like nowadays there are actually platforms where you can actually get position yourself. If
I
you
believe that these exist, and I think if you find some contracts for work, try to maybe find it in a franchised industry, because you know the franchises, they do communicate to one another, and if you finish some projects for one of them in the same area of business, likely there's going to be somebody else. So maybe that's an interesting approach. And yeah, the platforms kind of exist. They sort of like, you're almost like, I don't know if it's like Fiverr or not. I don't know. For development, I believe there are platforms too. I haven't looked in a while. I remember seeing a couple, but I haven't really looked into
Yeah,
that
there is
side of things.
Fiverr, there is Upwork, there is a Freelancer, there is a few of them actually,
Yeah.
and there is Twitter.
Yeah. X.
Yeah, X. Yeah, X. Yeah. Because I think social media also like it's a good way to position yourself to find a client. I think a way to use this type of means is to work in public, because most people, and also it depends on the work you're doing, because some projects you are not allowed to mention it, you're not allowed to talk about it to anyone. So, but there is a way you can showcase your skill somewhere and then market yourself on social media to get people interested. Like I know there were times where like I've been approached by different people and they just ask you like, oh, I have this project. Some people's projects, you know, you hear some people's idea about the project that they want to develop, and you are even scared to even engage in this type of conversation, because it's like they want to build the next what's that thing? That thing that goes to the moon, what's that? Rocket, you
Oh,
know, they want to build a rocket or something. Like, you know, it's scary, but you know, sometimes you'd say yes to some of it, and then some of it you just like choose what you can do and what you cannot do. But I think maybe this, but when it comes to like outside of finding clients and projects, but as a consultant, how do you like position yourself like in this role? Say for example, as a consultant, because I know like there are also some ways to manage your reputation and also to position yourself so you get being called for projects, because you're not the only one available, especially if you work for the sweatshop like you described it.
Yeah, that's a good question too. I think that you either have to be having a particular set of skills that are fairly unique, so that automatically, like, if you have a unique set of skills, it might be more difficult to obtain volume, but you can definitely get better rates for unique skills. If you're a generalist, you can work on different types of projects. And in terms of reputation building, yeah, you have to have portfolio, you have to have word of mouth. And the other thing too is about like promoting it on social media. Like, before you can start promoting yourself on social media, you have to promote your social media so people actually subscribe to you, which is, again, it's hard, it's a skill in itself, and it requires dedication of time and effort into it. So it's kind of a chicken and egg problem, right? Like, you have to have a popular social media presence before you can monetize it, but that takes effort. And if you're trying to use it to find work, like, you're not going to find anything in the beginning. So it yeah, it's tough.
But you know, like when you mention portfolio, sometimes I think about it like it's pretty common amongst developers now. Like especially the developers that do the positioning social media thing. A lot of people build a portfolio, but do you think the portfolio truly represents your expertise as a developer? Like, does it describe how much you know? Because I know some people who have like a lot of projects in their GitHub profile, for example, but you work with these people, it doesn't feel like, or like maybe you know this, you feel like, oh, maybe this person's still learning a lot of things, like,
Right.
yeah,
Well, if you go to someone's
but.
GitHub, you have to filter out the forked repos out of their repository because, you know, there's some people who like fork everything left and right, and their GitHub looks really, really busy, but you know, their own particular contribution. I don't know. Well, for me, a lot of the work that I've done is in private repos, and again, you're under NDA, so like you can't really show anything of that nature, and some of the stuff I do isn't really representable as such in code necessarily. Like, again, as you said, it's not going to give the best idea of my capability. And, you know, a lot of the code that I wrote 10 years ago, I probably look at right now and be like, please, let's pretend that didn't happen, right?
Exactly.
So, yeah, I mean, I have a couple of things on my GitHub, but it's not really indicative of too many things. Unless, like, I see some people who are like very big figures in open source movement. They like have all of these tools that they built and packages. Like, they're very notorious. But I think that if you reach that level, you probably invest way more time into that side of things rather than doing freelance work. Maybe you do freelance work based on the libraries that you've built, like integrating it with some for a company, they might hire you to like plug it into their systems. So yeah, I don't know. It's a difficult conversation. It's kind of out of my wheelhouse because I haven't really done it in a long time. I wouldn't really necessarily know where to start right now. So yeah, I mean, I think having a GitHub where you showcase what you have is good, but then you also need to take time to make sure that everything is in good state, right? And sometimes I don't know, it's kind of strange, you know, somebody, you know, you're interviewing somebody and you have a link to their GitHub and you open their profile and you like look at some code and they just do it in a style that is different to yours and you immediately like, ugh. Like they're putting curly braces on the next line and I put it on the same line and you already have that, like, you know,
You know what?
what's the modern popular term? The ick.
You know what? We need to address this. Should curly braces be on the same line or on the next line?
Curly braces you shouldn't care about it. You should have an automatic formatter that just picks a style for you and then everybody sticks to it. And that's everything that you need to do there. Like, there's literally no reason to invent new ways of formatting your source code. Just use a tool that has same defaults like prettier and you're set.
But do you put curly braces on the same line or on the next line?
Okay, so I in the in my infancy as a software developer,
I'm putting you on the spot right now.
yeah, I was using the language called Delphi from Borland, which is a flavor of Pascal. And in Delphi, you put your curlies on the next line. Such is life. And so because I came out of that, when I was writing PHP, I was putting my curlies on the same, or sorry, on the next line. And now, for the longest time, I was doing that, and then eventually, with the advent of automatic formatting tools, I realized that if I just install a tool that does everything for me, like prettier, I really like prettier for that reason, is because it barely has any configuration options. Like, it has, like, I don't know, now maybe it has more, but when it just came out, it literally had like five, maybe, if at that. And it produced consistent formatting that it took me a little bit to get used to, but then I said, you know, curly, like all of these things are basically arbitrary, and you can retrain yourself to be used to this other style in a matter of a week, and then you just don't have to think about it anymore.
It's true, but you know, like this is just a digress. We're digressing right now, but you know, like one thing I noticed is like I usually I put my curly braces on the same line, you know. I think I would really root for that. But I know like it's something that you have to really train yourself. Especially it depends. I would say it depends, really. It
Right.
depends on like the code base that you're working on.
Yeah.
For example, I had a different mindset of how to format my code. And using Prettier might not really go well with the team that you're working
But that's
because
the thing. No. Here's where I'm in vehement opposition to that. Especially if you have a deciding voice, you say, "No, we're not gonna get creative about such a stupid thing as formatting. Everybody installs Prettier, it runs automatically, everyone's code looks the same, the end. No conversations on it." There's literally no point in wasting time trying to convince people or them trying to convince you about merits of where the curly braces should be placed. Just
yeah.
no, just don't waste time on that. Everybody will suffer for a week, then they'll get used to it, not having to do that, not having to
Yeah.
argue constantly over this stuff, not having to have these stupid pull requests where it's like, "Ooh, your curly brace is on the wrong place. Maybe you can fix it." And then they don't use the suggestion feature, which is like, "Oh, just use the
Yeah.
goddamn suggestion
Yeah.
feature."
Yeah.
It just removes all of that. So if you're a benevolent dictator, be like, "No, not subject to discussion. We're using this. That's it. Conversation's over."
But you cannot argue this. Like, let's say
You
you're
don't
new
have
to
to.
the
You don't
thing.
have to. There's a
You cannot
tool.
really argue this thing. You
Yeah.
know, it gets to a point where you can start fighting in a team. Like, you know,
Yeah, but
if you're new.
that's why you don't argue about it. You make a decision and you force everybody to use it. I know it's not very
Yeah.
democratic, but who cares? I
I
mean,
guess. I
it's
guess.
not always a democracy, and I think it makes sense for the things that matter. Location of curly braces or tabs versus spaces does not matter in the slightest. Like you, there is no amount of force that is capable of convincing me otherwise, especially now with all the automated tools. You know, in fact, I was thinking about it, and what would be really cool if the code at rest, like, I mean, we're using plain text files, right? So I think you can do that in the editor, because maybe it's a complicated problem, but here's my thinking. When the editor loads the file from disk, it has the abstract syntax tree of all of the code in a file. And it can represent that same abstract syntax, because again, unless it's Python, spaces don't matter. Like indentation doesn't matter unless it's a language that is indentation specific, in which case it's a little bit different. But let's say it's JavaScript. Indentation mostly doesn't matter except for a couple of edge cases with like automatic semicolon insertions and things like that.
I don't agree with that,
But
but okay.
hold on, let me finish. So your editor, when it loads the file from the disk, can format it to the way that you want, and when you save it back to disk, it just stores abstract syntax tree that represents the logic of the code but doesn't necessarily care about formatting. So it's always at rest, it's always stored in the same format. And when it's presented to you, it can be in whatever format. You can have 25 empty lines between your curly braces if you so desire, because who cares? Maybe then everybody just gets to shut up about it, configure it the way they want, and like just stop that debate once and for all.
I agree. You know what? This part I agree with, but the part that formatting does not matter, I don't necessarily
No,
agree with.
it matters. It doesn't matter what you pick as long as everybody's on the same page. And having the tool that just gives you default formatting that's good just shuts down that conversation.
Everybody cannot be on the same page. You know what?
They have to be. They have to.
You know what? We
You
should
force them to it.
have an entire episode about this because
Oh
this is actually
no. Please, let's not do
we
that.
should have an episode about this because it's a really big deal. Because like you mentioned Prettier, but even some formatting of Prettier I don't really like. For example, when you have the say in JavaScript and then you have like
Yeah.
the import in different library, if you're importing a lot of things from the same library and you have that long chain of import, if you use Prettier it breaks it down for you and then you have your it's like in commas so it's vertical instead of the long ones. Sometimes if it's not like if it's like five it still breaks it down for you and you
Yeah.
still have the list. Those things I don't really I prefer to have if it's not too much for the screen. But you see this is my own preference,
Yeah.
right?
And who
But
cares?
at the end of the day, at the end of the day, the goal of having a good format is to like to help anybody else that's going to read your code understand right. and be able to, because like it's already daunting, you know, to yeah. actually want to read codes, and then you're not reading it in like a really messed up format. Yeah. Your if is somewhere here, your else is somewhere there, and then yeah. you're like your braces are everywhere.
I think that in a way, if you're importing so many things that you have to have so many lines, that in itself is kind of a smell, right? And if it's neatly like on a one line that just runs off the side of your screen and you can't see it, it masks a kind of a problem. And again, my whole point is your personal preference does not matter. You can retrain your brain to have the new preference in a matter of a week.
Yeah,
and then everybody's on the same page. You don't have to deal with a whole class of BS, and everyone's much happier as a result. There's no constant bickering about really thing. It's the ultimate bike shedding, you know. When you're tasked as a team, you're tasked with making a whole bunch of very complicated decisions, and nobody wants to take responsibility on far-reaching decisions that like drastically change the way of how everything is going to go. But people will waste hours and hours and hours arguing about what color to paint the bicycle shed on your parking lot. Like, just don't waste your time doing it. It's not worth it.
We should really have an episode about it. But let's go back to what we're talking about.
Sure. Yeah?
Like, last thing we're talking about is your portfolio and
yeah.
how it affects, like, how it describes you. In terms of your skill set, I know there was a time, you know, I really enjoyed that, you know, our a little digressed topic, but coming back to it, there was a time where like there was a trend where like HRs and like different people, they come to ask you for your portfolio. Like every time you apply for a job, they ask you like, oh, we want to see what you've done, especially if you don't have so much experience.
Right.
And I know some people at some point, they started like getting projects. Like literally you go on Udemy, you take a project, and then you just go put it on your portfolio.
Right. And
so like for me, I felt like it depends. Maybe there is a side to it that kind of makes sense, because like if you meet someone who you think has the criteria but not enough experience, maybe the portfolio can come in handy. But if you're talking to someone as a consultant, HR,
like a hiring person,
hiring person, and asking someone who has like few years of experience for like, oh, we want to see your portfolio, I don't think it's almost like downgrading, no? Like it's almost degrading a little bit.
It kind of is. Yeah. Okay. So here's my thinking on it. I think portfolio comes from different industries. Like from mostly like photographers have a portfolio. Designers have a portfolio. They have examples of the work they have produced, because their work, like the surface layer of their work is their work. Like a photograph is a photograph. There's no intricacies behind the photograph. You don't care. You look at the final result of the visual representation and be like, I like that person's style. I like their technique. I like their composition. I like how they capture the moment. Or if it's a design, it's like, I like how they work with shapes. I like how they work with highlights and shadows. I like how they pick their typefaces. I can work with this person. Their vision fits within the constraints of my vision. We can work together. For software, the surface level thing you see is the tip of the iceberg. Everything that is behind that, like there's no way to adequately represent that in a portfolio, because like you're not going to be going through the code of their back end. And again, so I think it doesn't fully represent your skill. And again, in order to establish your skill through that alone, you're missing a whole bunch of vital information. like you don't know what sort of operational constraints you were under, why you made those particular choices. Like you either have to literally spell and justify everything, which is really hard to do because normally you, like you don't really keep track of that unless you follow some techniques that we can talk about. And your decision process, decision-making process, is completely hidden from the observer of the final result, right? So they can't really make adequate judgments. And when you mentioned like doing projects of Udemy, it's like if you're a painter, would you put paint by numbers into your portfolio that can show that you can fill the color in a number slot? Like it's not indicative of you again as
a creative. You might have a creative way of doing it.
You might be having a creative way of doing it, but so far for a lot of junior developers who put their stuff on GitHub, it's going to be a bunch of like half finished typical projects that every type of bootcamp does. And it's very mm-hmm. obvious, and it's usually not particularly good. And it's not, I don't think like having something half-assed and half-baked in your portfolio is going to make a worse impression than not having anything at all. Like if it's in your portfolio, first of all, okay, if you're a photographer, you make thousands of photographs and your portfolio is maybe 30. So you curated very, very deliberately and very carefully. Only the best of the best reaches that level. But in code, my GitHub is public. Every tiny experiment and every kind of weird thing that I did is there. First of all, go like rummage through that pile of things and find some gems in there. Like you spend the time finding good stuff in the portfolio. It's a portfolio, right? It's on my GitHub. It's public. Like you go and spend time looking for things that you like. And how does that normally work? You open up randomly some project. You don't like it. That's it. Conversation's over. Like you're not going to waste your time going through 3 different projects or 5 or 10 to find if there's anything in there that's really good. They'd be like, okay, this guy actually knows his stuff. No, the first thing you don't like, you see, that's going to be the conversation ender, I think. You have to really curate it. You have to really put really good stuff in there. And if you're a junior and you're just starting up, you're unlikely to have very good stuff in there because just I haven't really seen it.
It's like you said it, like it's perfect, you know, but for me, I think it's good to have something in your portfolio, to have a portfolio, but I don't think it describes your ability really as a developer, because being a developer. And I guess like to say like a software developer means like you have the ability to write code, you can write, you're comfortable writing, but I think there is more to it. I think it's more about like being able to solve problems, yes, like being yes. able to actually like
it's analytical think, and systemic thinking.
So just like judging someone based on like the code that they have in their GitHub, I think it's really not good job as a HR or someone that decides who joins the team. But I think it's good to have just as a developer because, you know, in order, especially because our job has to do with a lot of like creativity and then my idea is not necessarily for you to build a portfolio really, it's for you to have things that you do to help you develop your skill because like if you spend time outside of work to learn a few things, having it in your portfolio or on a GitHub account, it's not the worst idea. I think it helps. This is my idea.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's a good idea, but I think that people, if they're using that to gauge your competence, you have to give them the best possible representation in the least possible form. Anything big and sprawling, they're not going to have time to go through and read. So it has to be condensed. You need to have an equivalent of like a TikTok video of a portfolio where they can look at it for 30 seconds and be like, yes. And it's really hard because code is such a small part of what we do. It's exactly. like it's the final result and it's a product of different lines of thinking and different constraints, mostly constraints, right? Because all of the projects that we work on, it is solving a specific business problem under a very specific set of constraints. And those things are invisible in code, or they you might be able to discern them, but there's other things at play too. And yeah, I think it's just very difficult to present something that is good, that adequately reflects your skill level. So I don't know. My thinking on it is, it's like, I've seen too many crappy GitHubs where people think that they're gonna, it's, you know, it's like an equivalent of free certificates from some online course on LinkedIn, where people just spam their LinkedIn. It's like, oh, I did this certificate. I did certificate in HTML. It's like, what do you freaking do, right? Like, okay, that is not impressive. In fact, it shows me that you're like tryharding. You're like trying to create an impression of yourself with these external factors. It's like you're decorating your resume with bling, but instead of it being Swarovski crystal, it's cheap glass. So, smells of a counterfeit, you know?
I mean, it depends. Well, yeah, it could be like that. The only thing is, as long as you're being true to yourself, like if you get a certificate and you actually studied it, you know what you got the certificate in, then that's good, fine. But if you just put in a certificate just because it looks good on your resume, then that is where the problem is. And that is where I have a problem with having a portfolio and, like, you know,
having a crappy portfolio.
Yeah, that's where I have a problem, because, like, if your portfolio says a lot of things about, like, oh, you did 10, 20 good projects, like, but in reality, when you're actually on the team, you're not as comfortable to actually work with other people or, like, do the work that you need to do, then then this portfolio is not really reflecting who you are, really. Like, that's where I have the problem. Like, I think it's about genuinity for me.
Yeah. Like, I mean, we talked about being a genuine self, right? So a lot of these aspects are true there too.
Yeah, and like,
I was just thinking about this other thing, is how your resume evolves through the years. Because I remember in the beginning, well, nobody knows any better. I mean, not many places actually teach you how to make a proper resume. And even when they do, they kind of operate with these cookie cutter templates for these things, and it's just like, not interesting. But in the beginning, you just pack it full of every possible technology that you ever touched, however tangentially.
True.
So you just keywords. True. I know all of these things, which means I looked at a book in a bookstore that the title mentioned this technology, and I consider myself knowing it, right? And then as the time progresses and as you evolve in your field, it becomes more of a, I will list core items about it in terms of, like, yeah, we worked in .NET, or we worked in Java, or we worked in whatever, but I'll spend more time describing the problem domain so that people, when they ask me about it, I'm not going to be like, it's like, tell me something interesting about the project. You're like, well, we did it in PHP. It's like, yeah, that's the least interesting part. I mean, unless you pick some really, really esoteric language, that can be a conversation starter. But overall, language is mostly immaterial to the conversation. It's more about, like, what challenges, what constraints have you overcome? What interesting things came along the way? And you kind of defend your approach in solving it. And so, ultimately, okay, here I think it just kind of crystallized it. You have to have a lot of conversation starters in there. You have to have all of these things that people can latch onto and be, tell me about that. Like, what was so interesting about that? If I give you a project with 1500 line or 1500 files full of code, it's impossible to find anything interesting about it. So you have to condense it to a couple of bullet points where it's like, we can talk about one time where, and, you know, the conversation progresses from there.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, finally, yeah, I wanted to ask you, you know, like, also when it comes to, like, portfolios, a lot of people nowadays no longer want to start, like, a project from scratch themselves, but to put in their portfolio. So, like, some of us try to find, like, open source projects, and you just want to contribute to open source. How do you feel about this kind of thing? Like, and the problem with open source is that, you know how I feel about it.
Yes.
I think not everything should be free. It's open source, but I think there should be some form of compensation. However, we can talk about this another time. But how do you feel about people who contribute to open source projects just as a way of building their portfolio?
I think it's a viable strategy. But again, we already had that conversation. Like, it has to be meaningful, right? It has to be meaningful. I think it's, to me, my contributions to open source were mostly out of necessity, where I needed to fix something that was impacting me or my project personally. Or something that I built for myself that there's nothing particular to it that requires it to keep it private. But yeah, if you're contributing to open source, good. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. And if you're contributing, again, it sort of boils down to that whole genuine bit. If you're contributing to open source for clout, it will be discovered, right? Sooner or later.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, true. But you see, again, if you're contributing to open source for cloud, I don't know if personally I would have a problem with that. This is my own opinion, really. I think for me, where the problem would be if what you're doing with the cloud, because for example, you can want to have attention to your career. You might want to just call, people to see that, okay, you're trying to sell yourself. Because at the end of the day, we are all doing business, we are all selling a skill. You might want to increase your own value, this can be your idea, but the thing is, like, are you actually doing it? Are you actually doing it? Because I've seen sometimes, like, some people, they say they contribute to open source, but they just like correct a few commas in the documentation, and that's their contribution to the open source. That's it. They contributed, but and then they put it on their Twitter links, like, open source contribute. But yeah.
That's the type of thing that I'm also not too happy with. But I mean, most open source work is, I mean, we did talk about it. We can refer back to that episode where we talked about open source. But yeah, I don't know if I have to add much to it.
They
So
can watch the video. They can, we had an episode
yeah,
about
we'll just I'll just link it somewhere in here. I'll have a card with that episode there, and you can watch it.
that. Yeah, but yeah. So I guess that's about it for me actually. Like I just wanted to know about freelancing and consultancy in tech, and I think it's been really insightful to learn how different things and like different ideas and how to stay relevant also like in this industry, because it keeps you on your toes a lot, and depending on how you work, maybe salary, maybe freelancing, maybe consultancy, we all have to keep improving each other, like improving ourselves and positioning ourselves better for better good opportunity and to grow in the industry and to also grow as a person really, because first you're a person before you're a developer, but it is
No,
what it
you have to grow in all aspects of your life, not
is.
just your
Exactly.
professional aspect as well.
Exactly. This is one thing that I really like enjoy with you, because I feel like I've had the opportunity to grow really as a person, also as a developer. Because we get to talk about real things, we get to talk about like relatable things, and you're very generous with your experience, you don't really like keep it to yourself, like hold back, and like you just tell it as it is, and it's really
I think
helpful.
it's an interesting thing to hoard in a sense. It's like, oh yes, I'm not gonna tell anyone what I did with my life. They'll never know the secret to my success,
People are like that. I tell you, like some people, they have like a lot of experience, but they don't want to share because they don't see the value in sharing.
Yeah.
There are people, they're different people. They just don't see the value in sharing. Like,
Yeah.
they
Well,
don't feel like
I
they
guess
have
like
the same life.
deliberately withholding and not seeing value in sharing are slightly different. I was kind of poking fun at people who would attempt to deliberately withhold that. I think, the thing is too is it's all so very circumstantial in a sense that I can share my experience, but if you were to do everything that I did, you're probably not gonna end up where I ended up. And so it's more of a different perspective on how these things happen. And you know, we talked about it that I'm not really prescribing anything. I'm describing what happened to me, and you can choose which bits and pieces to sort of pay attention to. And it could be different things to different people, right? Like, doesn't mean that I know I have the secret knowledge. It's like,
Maybe you do. Maybe you do. Just
maybe I do.
maybe
Maybe. See, if I
do.
continue thinking in that vein, I'll probably start a cult eventually, which is could be interesting.
Ooh, could be interesting. What would be the name of your club, let's say?
Oh, I have no idea. Now you're making me think about what my name, the cult name would be. So
What would they dress like? What would you wear?
this is where the Vasili's villain arc began.
That could, that's a nice name. Vasily villain art.
Yeah, villain's
VVA.
arc. Yeah, but you know how in comic books, you know, they have a person and something terrible happens to them, and that sets them on a path of becoming a villain.
If you ever start a cult,
Yeah, I'm
you would
just.
need
I mean,
social media.
well,
What
you know. It's interesting because
do
there are many cults out there, and there's a lot of people who are very susceptible to joining one in search of meaning or relationships or human connection. And it's kind of scary, come to think of it, is that how rational people or people who perceive themselves rational just kind of abandon all rationality and be like, hey, join the club. We got t-shirts.
You know what? You know what? Before people actually start thinking we are probably going to start a cult for real, like we just
Yes.
joking. We just
Join
joking.
the Telegram chat.
We just joking. We have Telegram channels, and we probably gonna put up some Discord channel as well. So
Yep.
we only talk tech, not nothing cult. We don't do
Yeah.
cult. We don't do
The cult of
that.
tech.
We only talk tech. So
Yeah.
yeah. Thank you again, Vasily. Thank you very much for your time today. So it's really nice to talk to you. We'll do the same next week.
We'll do the same next week.
All
Thank you very much, Mo. We'll be
right.
recording episode 10 next week, and
Let's
hopefully you will
go.
be with us. All right. Thank you,
Yes,
everyone.
yes.
Join the Telegram channel, share, like, and subscribe, all of the usual accoutrements, and have a great day.
Have a
Bye.
great day. Goodbye.